For the week of January 3rd, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 306, a podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy New Year, Sperling.
Happy New Year, Michael.
I hope one of your resolutions includes not saying phrases like, a little movie you might have heard about called Star Wars or something like that, you know, things like that. Let's in the new year, let's not do that.
No, actually, my New Year's resolution was I will never say, you see what I did there? You see what I did there?
No, I don't.
It's a joke. Get it?
No, I missed it completely, actually.
Oh, never mind. That was my New Year's resolution was to not point out the jokes like many of our listeners have requested repeatedly.
Oh, there you go. A good one.
Yeah. Well, you know, I try to please.
But of course, we will discuss Star Wars. We just won't refer to it as if you jokingly, oh, a little singer you might know about named Adele. You know, we won't do that. So we are going to discuss Star Wars. What else will we cover on this week's show?
Well, as you said, Michael, on this week's show, we start with, we're going to start with box office. And then we're going to move right on into box office so that we can discuss more box office. Star Wars is setting records, of course, but we've got a look back at all the trends in worldwide grosses from the past year. We'll cover how the winners at the box office are leaving nothing left for the losers, the increasing power of social media, and much more. Every week, you may know that we depend on RentTrak for worldwide box office figures, so who better to help us wade through the year at the box office than that company's senior analyst, Paul DeGarabedian? We'll wind up in the music industry during Inside Baseball. Lawsuits are always a good bellwether for the issues affecting an industry, and two big ones target Spotify and Ticketmaster. You probably have heard of them. We'll tell you what they are and what they could mean. That is, if they actually go to trial. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the major entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And of course, it's topped by Star Wars. We get all our information from RentTrak. We also pull info from Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Star Wars The Force Awakens. It grossed $184 million over the weekend. It's at $1.5 billion worldwide. Records are falling every day. And we'll discuss that and everything else when we get Paul DeGarabedian on the phone.
That's true.
I barely got his name out right. I try to pronounce Chinese, Mandarin, and I can't speak English.
I've been saying that for years, by the way.
At number two around the world is the first reason why Star Wars did not open in China. It's a Chinese film, and of course, December is a big month in China, just like it is all over the world, and they want to leave that space open for their own films, and it's certainly paying off. Number two is Detective Chinatown. This is a Chinese comedy mystery. I've seen it called Detective Chin Tang, but the English language translation, at least, seems to be Detective Chinatown. It grossed $45 million over the weekend. It's made $60 million so far. I guess it opened on a Wednesday. That would explain the extra $13, $14 million. I don't have budgets on this movie or most of the Chinese films, but it looks like it's going to be a pretty solid hit.
I'm tempted to make a joke here about how, the Chinese are always faulted for copying others' intellectual property. And I'm tempted to make the joke that in this film, there was a line that said, forget it, detective, it's Chinatown.
So in this year, your choice is to just tell jokes you're not going to tell. You're going to reference jokes that you're not giving. Is that the idea?
Exactly. We're talking about even.
We can look forward to that. At number three around the world, another Chinese hit. This is Mr. Six. It's a Chinese drama about an aging gangster who's fighting against young upstarts who have no honor. Don't you hate gangsters who lie and cheat and kill and steal and brutalize everyone around them and when they have no honor? That's really tacky.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's a myth, but we love that myth. And this movie's proving a big hit, $38 million over the weekend. It's just under $100 million in counting. So that's the second big end-of-the-year success story from China. At number four around the world is Daddy's Home, a comedy starring Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg. They both needed a hit, wanted a hit, and they got a hit. $38 million over the weekend, $115 million worldwide. They say the budget was $50 million.
Okay.
Asterisk. I mean, Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg, they're two pretty big names, right? So if they made this movie for $50 million, they're getting some back end, aren't they?
Well, they're also producers and they're also, yeah, so they're definitely getting some back end. This is how Hollywood is working these days. Not everybody's making $20 million up front. Now it's, hey.
No, most people never did.
Well, true. Yes. But
the,
you know,
10 big names in the world might, but you know, for the right project, but yeah.
Yeah, but they were making 10, 12, $15 million, you know, on a regular basis. But now it's more like, hey, you know what? We'll pay you five. And if the film does well, you'll reap the rewards. Of course, you'll have to actually call your lawyer to make sure you do reap
well,
the rewards.
It's not a net profit issue. So it's very different.
Yes, I would imagine so.
Yeah, they're not getting into that case. So just like the rest of us, Hollywood is tightening its belt.
Yes, exactly.
Make that movie for $7 million. But, you know, if they've doubled their budget, they're going to triple their budget before all is said and done. So everybody's going to be happy. And number five around the world, the biggest blockbuster hit in China from December, it's Mogen, The Lost Legend.
This was a film that would have opened against Star Wars if China let Star Wars open in December. And it went on to make $230 million. Well, I guess, what was it? It was like $120 million opening for that film, I think.
Yeah, it was a monster opening, but it's still going strong. $32 million over the weekend, $230 million worldwide. It's a fantasy adventure about a young team of Tomb Raiders, and it's based on a hit online novel. It cost just under $40 million to make. That's what they say. I get sort of a Raiders of the Lost Ark Ghostbusters vibe from the trailer. So a big, big hit for Mogen. That hasn't opened up in the U.S. yet, unlike Mr. Six, which did open, I think, on about 28 screens. It is playing and made about $1 million so far in North America. Why let people pirate the movies? Just let them go to the theater.
I agree.
At number six around the world is Alvin and the Chipmunks 4, $22 million over the weekend, $91 million worldwide. That's just about what the movie cost to make. So it may be a while before we see Alvin and the Chipmunks 5. At number seven is an Italian hit. It's Quo Vado, or I Go to Court. It's a new comedy. It stars Checco Zalone, who it's his, you know, he's a big hit star in Italy. It's his fourth hit film in a row. It opened at $20 million over this weekend. The reviews have been a little soft for him. I don't think he's a huge critically acclaimed guy, but even the people who like him seem to think this one's a little soft towards the end. But still, another hit film for Checco Zalone. Will he cross over to the U.S. or anywhere else in the world? I don't know, but with $20 million, he probably doesn't need to.
Everybody loves me.
Well, that's right. I mean, and also, you know, I'm assuming the budget, it's just a straightforward comedy, was pretty modest by international standards, and therefore $20 million in opening weekend is more than the whole movie cost to make. At number eight is Joy, the David O. Russell film. I saw it over the holidays. I liked it more than I expected, I have to admit. It's not a great movie, but I liked its sort of weird off-kilterness, but that may be the very thing that's keeping it from being as successful as the last few David O. Russell films. It made $19 million over the weekend. It's at $51 million and counting. Jennifer Lawrence is probably going to be in the mix for an Oscar nomination. And if they show this movie love like they have his other films, that may be something that gives it legs that it isn't showing right now.
Jennifer Lawrence is becoming like Meryl Streep. She can like show up for the opening.
Well, another 15 movie nominations and then we can talk about that.
Okay, fine.
And number nine is the Peanuts movie. She is on a great roll though. The Peanuts movie at number nine, $17 million over the weekend. $200 million worldwide. Of course, this movie cost $100 million to make, but there are some good things to keep in mind, aren't they? It's animated, right? So there are no big name actors getting a piece of the gross, right?
No.
There's no profit participant, except maybe the Schultz estate.
Yes, that is correct.
And it's a family film, and it got really good reviews, right? What does that mean?
Unless Fox bought this movie outright, which I cannot believe they bought the rights, and the Schultz estate would say, okay, you get everything. I can't believe that. So, this is definitely a moneymaker, and you can expect to see a sequel.
Right, and it's a family film, which means what happens on the back end with DVD and Blu-ray and video on demand. It does a lot better, typically. A well-reviewed family film typically does a lot better than most other genres, right?
That's correct.
And, of course, it isn't just about the movie here. You know, you want to keep the Peanuts name in front of people's faces. And while the comic strip is still run in reruns all over the world, naturally, having a big hit film really helps power the book collections, the comic strip, the merchandise, the calendars, and all that other stuff that means Peanuts. So, you know, it's really a win for them, even though they have yet to triple their budget.
I just had a great idea, and this is like a Jerry Seinfeld moment for me. You know how he came up with that idea for...
Well, he had a great idea for a sitcom, and now he's a billionaire.
Well, okay, and it was a sitcom about nothing. And then he had that idea for, you know, what if you made a movie, and it was really bad, and you called it a B-movie, and it starred a B? Well, what if you had the Peanuts characters for adults, okay, and they were like using profane language and everything, you could call them salty peanuts. I need my cricket.
Not bad.
Okay.
At 10 is The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's movie opening wide, $16 million over the weekend. It's gone into digital projection, even though it's still the roadshow production is holding over in most places because it did very well. It's hit $30 million worldwide. It's tracking lower than the last few Tarantino movies, which were the biggest hits of his career, but it's doing solid business. It costs $44 million to make. And again, the Oscars love him, so that may help give this movie the legs that some people are saying it's not going to have.
Well, a lot of critics were, you know, that I read, okay? So the critics that I read were like, you know, Tarantino, you may have jumped the shark.
He didn't. No one said he jumped the shark.
No, but they said
people said he jumped the shark. They said this wasn't his, some critics said it wasn't his best movie, right? Is that what you're saying?
Okay, yes. That's what I'm trying to say.
The shark, meaning the guy's never going to make a good movie again, which is what that means, a TV show where, you know, they've gone off the rails and never will anybody enjoy it ever again.
Well, okay. They didn't say that, but
Top critics gave it a 62% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. I mention that because, boy, has Rotten Tomatoes just absolutely, I mean, I hear friends referencing it so casually all the time now. Oh, I got a 92 on Rotten Tomatoes. Oh, I got an 87. It is just part of the lexicon now, isn't it?
It's just like the Parker rating for wine or wine enthusiast rating. Well, yes. It got a 90 points on wine enthusiast. It must be a good wine. Well, I'm pretty sure it tastes like spoiled grapes. You know, I agree. And did you read all that stuff about how the 70mm prints were breaking and the...
Well, they said there were just a few, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not surprised because people aren't using it anymore. So suddenly you've got people who haven't been working with it for years or ever. And suddenly they're back in the saddle trying to work with, you know, a print. It's hard to do.
And I have to say, I'm really impressed that they even found 100, you know, pieces of equipment to stick in theaters to show.
Well, they
this
bought film. Everything they could, right? They kept it really quiet, and they ran around the world buying up those old 70mm projectors, and didn't want anyone to know it was them. They used like shell companies so that they could buy them because they were worried the price would go up. So they literally went all over the world and secured every single one that they could before people figured out who it was and what they were doing, because then they figured they'd be over a barrel.
That's true.
There's a great little story about the whole launching of this movie, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, that type of roadshow, it's not going to happen
very often.
No, not at all. And it didn't happen previously very often either. So,
Well, I mean, it was a sort of a regular, I mean, it wasn't for, you know, every other movie, but it was sort of a regular tradition in Hollywood, wasn't it? You'd get a little program, you'd see the movie, be a whole show, you get reserved seating, have a premium pricing. It wasn't invented in the 90s.
No, absolutely not. No, it was, you know, Spartacus, The Sound of Music, you know, like these big, big movies. Ben-Hur.
I don't know that The Sound of Music was a roadshow, was it?
Well, they had the intermission and it was shown on 70mm, so I believe it was.
Okay. It's certainly a big movie. And I think this is another solid commercial hit for Tarantino, who knows how to make movies on a dime and, you know, make a profit for everybody involved. At number 11 is Point Break, a movie that is not going to make a profit for everyone involved. It costs $100 million to make. It's at $80 million worldwide. It's falling hard everywhere it is. It's only in 22 territories right now, and it is a visual spectacle. So maybe it will do better in other parts of the world. I'm not sure how much of a player the movie was in its original incarnation, whether people even know this film. Clearly, there's no Fast and Furious movie, so maybe they'll go see Point Break right now. But it's doing better overseas, and it's tripling its American grosses, but that's not going to be enough to get this to final profitability.
Maybe that's because nobody overseas saw the original Point Break, and they're like, hey, this looks like a pretty unique idea.
At number 12 is Pixar's The Good Dinosaur, which again looks like the rare commercial flop for that studio. $13 million over the weekend, $250 million and counting. At number 13 is Sisters, the Tina Fey, Amy Poehler comedy. Great counter programming, just like that daddy movie up there. $30 million it cost to make. It's at $66 million and counting worldwide. At number 14, a movie that's an Oscar hopeful, it's The Big Short. It's had a nice, solid opening. It's really timed itself well for some good Oscar consideration and capitalizing on that at the box office. It made $11 million over the weekend. It's at $37 million and counting. They haven't gone huge in North America. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it is huge because they're on like more than 1,000 screens, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're on 1,500 screens. You can make $100 million on 1,500 screens. So it's not like they're tiny, but when movies open more like on 2,500, 3,500, 4,000 screens, being on just 1,500 screens is seen as sort of modest, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely a platform release.
Well, not now. Not that it's at 1,500, you're not platformed anymore. Have we changed the definition of a wide release? Surely that still includes 1,588 theaters.
I'd have to... I'd have to ask
that's
somebody.
That's a wide release.
Yeah, I'd have to ask some folks in distribution what they consider a wide release.
Surely we'd still say anything less than 1,000, and that's been since maybe the 90s?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, $100 million used to be a lot of money.
That's true. and in my mind, it still is, by the way.
Yes, if you had it. But The Big Short is ready for some Oscar love, and that could really take this movie over the top. And number 15 is one of the films that kept Star Wars from sweeping the board in worldwide records. That's The Himalayas. It's a South Korean action drama about a doomed mountaineering expedition based on a true story. Another $11 million over the weekend. $43 million in counting. It can always be the answer to that trivia question. What movie kept Star Wars out of the number one spot on opening weekend in South Korea? And number 16, another Chinese film. This is Little Door Gods. It's a Chinese animated fantasy comedy about door gods. You say, hey, why don't people believe us anymore? We're dying off. And they enter the world in order to try and shake people up. And adorable mayhem ensues. It opened, I guess, on a Wednesday or a Thursday. It's made $12 million so far. And number 17 is Concussion, the Will Smith film. This looks, it's a modest bet, $35 million. When all is said and done, no one's going to lose their shirt. But it's gotten friendly, polite reviews. He may still get an Oscar nomination, though I don't think so. But not doing great at the box office. $9 million over the weekend, $26 million and counting. Hunger Games, the final part, hit $635 million worldwide. And then we've got one more Chinese film. We've got two more left. We've got Heart for Heaven. This is a goofy romantic comedy. It opened this weekend. It's made $7 million. I guess, I beg your pardon, opened on Wednesday because it's at $10 million and counting. And then a little bit below that is Ip Man 3. This is a Hong Kong martial arts drama. I'm not sure about the distinction between Hong Kong and China anymore. I mean, those entities are merging a lot, aren't they?
They are, but I think that the industries consider themselves separate.
Uh-huh. So it's a Hong Kong-originated film. It stars Donnie Yen as the famous martial arts master, and it cost $36 million to make, and it made $5 million over the weekend. It's the third in the franchise, of course. It's at $15 million and counting.
Well, Michael, that I know that you probably have about five or six other films like The Danish Girl and In the Heart of the Sea and Bridge of Spies that you want to talk about, but that really, that's the past week. That's what happened over New Year's weekend. What we really wanted to focus on today is what happened in 2015, what's going to happen in 2016, and where does the industry stand box office-wise? And there is nobody better to talk to on that than RentTrack senior analyst Paul DeGarabedian. Paul, thank you for joining us once again.
Great to be here.
Paul, let's start with Star Wars, shockingly enough. Of course, it continues to set records. It set an IMAX record for North America, $100 million and counting. I think it set a New Year's Day record or New Year's Eve record. All sorts of records are falling. What I was amazed by and fascinated by was how often they would say something like, oh, it hit this record in 10 days. Jurassic World did it in 11. It broke this record in X number of times, but Jurassic World did it just a little bit. I mean, Jurassic World really was a big hit earlier in this year, and it's been overshadowed a bit by Star Wars, but really it was amazing how close it was as far as all these records fall. I mean, Star Wars isn't done yet, of course, but that we can kind of forget this is a year where we've had five movies enter the all-time top 11 grossing films worldwide, period, ever. Five movies from 2015 have broken onto the charts. That's kind of unprecedented, isn't it?
It is. And to have the biggest opening weekend of all time in North America and worldwide broken not once, but twice in 2015 is unprecedented and amazing. And, you know, you're right. I mean, when it comes to, you know, Jurassic World, its place in the sun was very short-lived. I mean, usually when you have a movie open with over $200 million, that record will stand for a while. I mean, the first Avengers movie, $207.4 million, at least it had a few years there to bask in the glory of that. Jurassic World, you know, was kind of the benchmark. And certainly for a summer film, you expect big opening weekends and that kind of thing. But that movie just kind of blew the doors off everything. And then we knew, though, that Star Wars would be so big. And when you talk about records, I mean, fastest film to 100 million, 200 million, 300 million, 400 million, 500 million, to hit 740 million in North America in just 17 days. Is just, I mean, it's unbelievable. To me, it's not even the numbers. It's the speed. It's like these land speed records. that this movie is setting, and you know, get to $1 billion in record time. And now it's going to probably today or tomorrow be the biggest movie of all time in North America, surpassing Avatar's $760.5 million. Could this be the first movie to hit $1 billion in North America?
Well, certainly it's one of two movies this year that surpassed $600 million in 2015, which is the first time there's ever been two movies that have made that much money in the same year.
Yeah, it's incredible. No wonder we got to a record box office year. We hit $11 billion for the first time in North America, and we're going to go well over $38 billion, maybe close in on $40 billion worldwide. We still are tallying some of those numbers from the international territories as we speak at RenTrak. But yeah, what a year. I mean, from beginning to end, from American Sniper, 50 Shades of Grey, Furious 7, Avengers Age of Ultron, Jurassic World, of course, we talked about that, Minions, and then some really cool movies like Mad Max, Fury Road, which I absolutely love, Straight Outta Compton, Creed, some really good movies that were not necessarily the top earners, but made an impact.
Well, that was the great news for distributors, wasn't it? There were records set in virtually every month, like a record January, record February, and on, because it wasn't limited to just one or two movies in summer and Christmas. There were big hit films almost every month of the year.
That's right. And for me, having done this for 23 years now, I've never had a year where I had to keep writing. You know, everything was in pencil, you know, record broken, then erase, and then put in a new record, because just month after month, we had this incredible outpouring of support for the movie theater experience. And I want to address something really quick that keeps coming up. People always say, well, with higher ticket prices, ticket price inflation, of course, we're breaking records. And if you look back and adjust for inflation, you know, back to something like Gone with the Wind or even the first Star Wars movie, that those movies would really be much bigger than the movies today. But I argue that in the face of that, you know, ticket inflation is also technology inflation. Look at how many more options people have for entertainment on the small screen, on their on the go, in the home, on demand, home video. It's been like it is never before. And for the movie theater experience to still be breaking records, and at least attendance is about flat with last year and not dropping at a precipitous rate, tells you that going to the movie theater is still a great pastime, but you have to have the movies to back it up, because there's a lot of great content on the small screen.
Well, and I was going to kind of make a joke about how, you know, all of the, I know this is like the show where I talk about the jokes I'm not going to make, but I was going to say, you know, look at the top 10, you've got all that original material.
Oh yeah. Very original.
Yeah. I mean, it's all based on, you know, they're either reboots, they're sequels, or they come from a known franchise like a Marvel.
I know. Thank God for The Martian, you know, because at least that, I mean, it was based on a book, but it wasn't a sequel or a franchise. Straight Outta Compton, based on, you know, it's funny because everything is branded in a way. Even Straight Outta Compton had a reference point, of course, but it wasn't a sequel, and it did incredibly well. Creed didn't feel really like a sequel to me because it was so different than the other Rocky movies, but it was such a great film. And then you had films like The Big Short, Spotlight, Carol, The Danish Girl, you know, all these really good indie films in the mix on top of that. But, you know, of course, there's always casualties in every year. I think the social media component has become stronger than ever and a more, you know, impactful part of how movies do, whether positive or negative. I mean, like with Fantastic Four, definitely the director tweeting negatively about the movie and others. That hurt that film. Mission Impossible 5, Straight Outta Compton, Jurassic World all benefited, and obviously Star Wars benefited from huge social media buzz in the positive realm, and I think that really helped all those movies.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because, you know, when you look at that, you have Chris Aaronson, the head of distribution at Fox, saying there is no bottom anymore, and he really looks and points at social media as you know, you can't just do a big marketing blitz and expect a $20 million opening. That now your big marketing blitz gives you $10 million. And and there are people pointing at several reasons for that, not only social media, but also the fact that television commercials aren't as effective as they used to be. Isn't that the case?
Chris Aaronson's a great executive. He knows his stuff. And I think that is the case in a way. I think people are getting there. I mean, obviously in theater marketing and trailers, to which many more people are exposed when there's a lot of hustle and bustle, a lot of foot traffic in the multiplex, that still plays a big part. There's a lot of time shifting, a lot of DVRing, you know, a lot of the TV spots for movies are, you know, not seen because, like me, I buzz through commercials. But of course, the online viewing of trailers and information on movies is a big part of this as well. So it's become all kind of interwoven as to how people get their information on film, how they get excited about going to the movies. And a lot of people, of course, are buying tickets online from, you know, movietickets.com, Fandango, the various services. Beyond that, too, you just have to have a great in-theater experience that the movie theaters, I think, today are really providing with the immersive picture and sound. Remember, it's highly competitive. So when people go to the movies and spend that hard-earned dollar, they have to come out of there feeling like, I want to go back and do this again, not I want to go rush home and binge watch and not go back to the theater.
Well, I have to laugh at some of that, because when people say, why didn't we make some money off these movies? Was it because people are DVRing through their trailers? Or not? When you're looking at Pan and Jupiter Ascending and Fantastic Four and Tomorrowland and Pixels, these are all horribly rated movies. They're just flops. And that's, it's true, right, that nowadays you can't get away with a really bad movie and eke some money out. I don't know that that's a bad thing. You know, you're not suckering people into seeing a bad movie and going to the theater and having a bad experience. I'd be more concerned if there were good movies that were falling through the cracks. You know, yeah. Give me an example of 10 movies that should have made more money and that didn't, or, you know, felt like people ignored for some bizarre reason. But those movies don't really need an explanation. I mean, if social media is helping people figure out quicker, hey, don't waste your money on that movie. Well, I'm sorry, but the answer is to make a better movie.
You make a great point, because you know what? That is the beauty of the social media component. It's not just the elite reviewers or critics telling people what to watch. It's actually the collective audience who is telling each other, this movie's great or this movie is not so great. And I think that's good. You can't hide behind marketing hype if you release a bad movie. If Star Wars had been a terrible movie, once it was released, that would have been found out very quickly and would have been tweeted and Facebook about all over the place. It just puts an added layer of responsibility, I guess, or pressure on filmmakers that you can't just hide a bad movie. You can't just marketing hype it to death and get a big opening weekend, then on Monday have the water cooler discussion, kill your movie, but you got a lot of money in the bank very quickly. Now the water cooler, the virtual water cooler, takes 1 hour. You know, the first person who sees the movie, or the first group of people who see it around the world, start tweeting about it, the word is out right then.
And it begins and ends on Thursday night, doesn't it?
That's right. It happens Thursday. It actually does. Happens within the first hours, especially on those previews that happen on a Thursday night before a Friday opening. But that's good. You know, you should look at the level of competition on the small screen. If you look at some of these, the great original programming on Netflix and other platforms like Narcos or Orange is the New Black, and, you know, even content like Sopranos, which is available on demand all the time, that's a very high bar. And so now that people have those options, you just have to make that movie theater experience vis-a-vis a great movie, getting people in the theater and coming back. Because you can have the best movie theater in the world, the best sound, the best picture. That isn't going to save a bad movie. If it's not in the writing, the directing, the experience, a positive experience, it's not going to help your movie. You still need to have the goods to back it up.
Well, then, you know, I think if you want a really great experience, you have to see the movie in 3D, which is Michael's favorite way of seeing movies, is in 3D. Of course, I'm being sarcastic. Yeah, he's
I love it if it's well done. I just don't think every movie should be released in 3D. And I think that's what we've found out to be the new normal. Every movie is not getting released in 3D. And we're seeing big new movies top out at 40% on opening weekend of total grosses. And that seems to be where we're at now, that big, you know, blockbuster movies that seem right for 3D will get released in 3D, but it's not every movie every week. And people are not going to see, you know, 80%, 90% of ticket sales are not in 3D. If it's something like Avatar, they'll hit those numbers again. But it seems like 3D and the premium formats are a huge permanent factor now for the distributors, aren't they?
They are. And for a movie like Star Wars, that reinvigorates the notion that 3D is great, whereas other movies that were, you know, that did not present the 3D in the best possible way. Remember, people are paying more money for that ticket, so by virtue of that fact, they're expecting more for their money. And if all you're getting is some really bad conversion of a not so great movie, you're just going to be angry when you walk out of the theater. But something like Star Wars, like Mad Max, Fury Road, Gravity is another example.
Gravity is a good example, really, but I haven't heard a single person mention Star Wars as having great 3D. I didn't hear anybody say it was terrible, but I don't know anybody said, oh my God, you must see this movie in 3D.
You know, Disney was reporting like 47% of the opening weekend came from 3D, which is a pretty high number. But you know, if the movie is good, it doesn't have to be in 3D. But, you know, if it's a great movie, I think seeing something in IMAX 3D can really elevate that experience. But it's not a panacea. It shouldn't be a crutch like, oh, we'll just make a movie an instant event by doing that. But if the movie, again, it still has to be a good movie. You can't sell people, and by bad movie, I mean, it could be, that's a very subjective thing, but certain movies we're all aware are not great movies. Now, this year, the top echelon of films, you could argue, are some of the best reviewed. I mean, I think Jurassic World got great reviews, Star Wars, Inside Out, Furious 7, American Sniper, by and large, The Martian certainly got great reviews. So when you have that intersection of, you know, popular appeal, but also great reviews from those who know, you get magic there. You get the combination of both, a blockbuster that's actually a good movie.
Well, I'd say that if the studios were excited by their 3D numbers, they'd report it at the end of a run rather than just at the beginning. Jurassic World had great legs in 3D. People clearly kept going to that movie week after week and wanting to see it in 3D. Yeah. But nowadays, all we hear about is the opening weekend numbers. But another thing that studios are concerned about is some of the have-nots said, oh my God, this year's box office was dominated by Disney and Universal. It's so unfair. You know, it's either you win big or you lose completely. Is that true? Because if I look back over the past 40 years, every decade, when I look at 2005 and 95 and 85, it looks like, you know, one or two studios typically dominate the year. That's just how it works. Some years you have a great lineup and some years you don't.
You're absolutely
is this
right.
Idea, you know, is this normal? Isn't it?
It is. I mean, look, next 2016, it'll completely change. I mean, you rise and fall on your movie slate and Universal seemingly could do no wrong. In 2015, they had way more hits than misses, although they had a few that didn't work. But overall, any studio would kill for the year they had. Disney almost caught up at the end by virtue of all that Star Wars money. But it does kind of flip-flop around. I mean, for years, Warner Brothers was on top, particularly when they had a Harry Potter movie every year or a Matrix movie or a Batman movie. And Disney, with all that they bring to bear in terms of their collective brands, Pixar, Marvel, and of course Lucasfilm now, they are automatically going to be in the mix in the top ranking studios. But you know, fairness doesn't really come into it. It's just about, does your slate resonate and therefore does your studio rise to the top of the rankings? It could all flip-flop this year. It could be totally different in 2016.
Well, before we move on to 2016, which I do have a question about attendance and trends, but really we're kind of avoiding the big elephant in the room, and it's something you mentioned in the announcement of the $38 billion plus worldwide box office, which is an estimate at this point. Right. But you mentioned the importance of international markets, and there are record-setting years in Brazil, and South Korea had, you know, 5 years running a straight, I guess they've had a record ticket sales. They only count ticket sales, not gross. Right. Italy and France also had great years. So, I mean, and of course, China's the 800-pound gorilla in the room I'm sure people look at North America as that, but everybody is waiting for China to overtake North America as the leading movie marketplace. But I don't know where the question is here, but
I have a question for you. When I look at the worldwide box office, I see North America contributing $11 billion and the rest of the world contributing $27 billion. And that's barely double what North America does on its own. And that tells me, my God, we've got a lot of room to grow.
I think you're right. I think China is building brick and mortar theaters at an amazing pace every day. It's the second biggest movie market, as you said, Sperling, but it's going to, I think, by the end of this decade, surpass North America as the biggest movie market. When we at Rentrak have looked at the average summer blockbuster, on average, about 70% of the revenue is at the box office in theaters is being earned outside of North America. And so that tells you how important that is. And you're right, there is room for growth. And I think, you know, it's sort of the tail wagging the dog to talk more about the North America than the international, when the international is so huge and contributes so much to the bottom line. But, you know, it's also a matter of, do those movies play well everywhere? And when you look, when we're talking about brands that people understand and know, a lot of sequels at the top of the chart, that isn't just a North American phenomenon. It seems that audiences all over the world like the tried and true, the familiar. And look, I don't care if a movie's the 10th installment, if it's a really good movie, I don't have a bias against a sequel if it's a great movie. I don't care if it has a number after the title or whatever, although it's great to see original films if they're good. If they're not good, they fall flat too. Just being original doesn't make it good. But I guess I'm going into the weeds a little bit. But yes, the international component is huge. In 2016, it'll continue to be a big, big part of that. And with some big Marvel movies, DC movies coming out, some big sequels and a lot of other big films for 2016, I think that trend's going to continue.
Well, and it's not just sequels, it's Hollywood movies that are making money. And, you know, you look at France, yeah, and I think 54% of the box office was, yeah, Hollywood movies. And Italy, the top movies were, I think it was Inside Out and Minions. Even in Brazil, it was all, not all American, but mostly American movies. And in South Korea is the one area, the few territories where there was some evening out. And in fact, I think Korean movies outpaced Hollywood fare.
Yeah, and in China, they have quotas and they have blackout periods. And they had a movie called Monster Hunt, which did incredible business in China alone, or in 12 territories total outside of the U.S. So you can have homegrown titles that do very, very well. But we count that all into the 38 billion plus gross, and, you know, for the worldwide in 2015, we do that in every year. But yeah, it is mainly Hollywood fare, like Star Wars, that's up to, a you know, over $1.5 billion already after just, 19 days or so, 18 days in worldwide release. So a lot of that is, and it has, and by the way, Star Wars opens in China on Saturday, January 9th.
And that's so right. Look,
there's going to be a whole new rush of money towards that movie. We'll just have to see how much.
Well, and that's why we always talk about worldwide box office. We say focusing on North America is like focusing on the box office in Tennessee. You know, what's the point? You want to know how much it's made overall. And of course, winners and losers change a lot when you don't look at just North America, but the entire world. And we depend on RentTrak. And I guess you depend on the studios and people to report to you the numbers, right? You're not going ferreting out information, because there's a lot of countries. And once in a great while, we find some movies slip through the cracks that maybe should have been on the charts, which are really dependable and great, but somehow they didn't report it. And therefore, you guys don't have the info.
Yeah, sometimes that comes from some of the smaller distributors don't report on Sunday. Often we'll get, you know, when we do the estimates, and often on Monday, they'll finally report, and then it winds up in our finals chart. But we actually get information directly from over 120,000 screens around the world. So we're right at the fire hose, if you will, of the theaters, and then we provide that information to the studios. But the international side of our business is absolutely staggering, but it's not immediate in the same way that the North American grosses come in. So on Sunday, we'll have a worldwide weekend chart by midday rather than at 8 a.m. Pacific time. But that's just the nature of the beast. But I think that international without it, I mean, where would the box office be? It'd be a whole different type of thing. And like you said, when we have 11 billion in North America, 27 billion or so from the rest of the world, that tells you how important the rest of the world is.
And I think it's important to underscore what you just said. You are getting your information from the point of sale systems at box offices around the world. Now, I guess at least in North America, you're getting it from POS systems. My question is, are you getting that from POS systems and the cash registers in France or in the UK or in Korea?
It depends on the territory, and I could get really in the weeds on this, but we have offices in virtually all of those territories. And so RentTrak is literally getting this information directly. I believe most of it is still point of sale everywhere in the world, but I'm sure there are some areas where it's done a little bit differently. But at the end of the day, we're getting all those grosses, and without them, we wouldn't really know, you know, obviously how these movies were doing on that worldwide basis. So when you break out just the international side of things, I mean, to think that Avatar made $2 billion just internationally. I mean, I've been saying could Star Wars hit $3 billion? And a lot of people said there's no way. And I'm saying, well, we have to wait and see. It's already at $1.5 billion worldwide. It could get to $1 billion in just North America. Could it do $2 billion like Avatar just internationally? We'll have to wait and see.
Well, and if it makes whatever it makes in North America, I would expect it to make at least twice that much in the rest of the world.
So if we get to $1 billion in North America, you do the math. I mean, I don't see this thing running out of gas, but remember, it's like driving a race car. You get up to 200 miles an hour, then to get to 202, 203, 204 miles an hour, it takes a lot more effort to get there. And I know it's kind of a weird analogy, but with the box office, it's kind of the same thing. As time goes on, just gets a little harder to get to each of those milestones. But at the record-breaking pace and the breakneck pace that Star Wars is doing all these things, it's just astounding. I mean, it took Avatar the 48-week entire run to get to $760.5 million, and Star Wars could do it today or tomorrow.
Well, that's the beauty of digital prints and wide, wide releases.
Absolutely.
I look at one website called Box Office Profits. They have some fun analysis, and they made a good point about Star Wars. Of course, Rogue One, a prequel that takes place between Star Wars 3 and 4, that comes out Christmas 2016. It's 11 months away at the end of this year. And then they said the next two in the trilogy, Star Wars 8 and 9, they come out on Memorial Day. And they said, given the record pace of this movie and the tradition that they will have of two Christmases in a row, maybe they should delay it and make it a Christmas tradition. Why not wait till December?
That's necessarily a bad idea. Although, some of the biggest movies of all time have come from that, kickoff of the summer, either early May or Memorial weekend. So that's also a good spot. But it's no accident that Avatar and Titanic are the two highest grossing movies of all time worldwide. They both open the same time in their respective years as Star Wars, The Force Awakens. In fact, Avatar had the same release date in 2009, which was December 18. Titanic, December 19, because you have a much more unfettered playing time. You have much more playability from December into January, February, March. Although in recent years, January, February, March have really come up in the world in terms of their box office viability in some of the big movies like American Sniper, 50 Shades of Grey. The first Hunger Games movie was a March release. So, but still, it's a much more, I agree with that assessment, though, that maybe just make it a Christmas tradition. Although I don't know, the industry, they had to deal with that movie this Christmas, and it changed a lot of the dynamics of the box office during the holiday period. But I think it actually, its first weekend may have hurt some of the other movies, but in its second and third weekends, we saw Sisters doing really well, Daddy's Home, some of the other movies doing great. We had a record New Year's weekend this weekend, with Star Wars and those other movies all doing well.
Well, we're kind of talking about the future and 2016, 2017, and yet we kind of just looked back at all of these records and record grosses and record attendance. And I guess there's a lot of kind of speculation now about 2016 that it can't live up to 2015.
No, it's going to be tough. It's always hard to come off a record year. It's great to have a record year and all these records broken, but then the following year, how do you live up to that? That's what happened in 2014. 2014 was a down year because 2013 was a record-breaking year. And then because 2014 was way down, 2015 looked spectacular by comparison, even though I think objectively it was a spectacular year in 2015. But that's the thing. How does 2016 live up to this? And what are the headlines going to be a year from now? Hopefully Rogue One will have enough juice to punch up the box office at the very end. But I don't know that it can be as big as The Force Awakens, but we'll have to wait and see on that one as well.
Is there anything that you're really kind of got your eye on right now for 2016 where you're kind of tracking it and thinking, okay, this one might be big or that one looks
not so much from that perspective. I'm more like a film fan at this point. So like Suicide Squad, when I see that trailer, that gets me pumped up. Captain America Civil War, that looks really cool. I love Neighbors and there's Neighbors too. I'm not talking about like the more esoteric movies, but from a blockbuster standpoint, I think we should really look at DC Comics because now they're getting into they're really putting it out there. It's always been about Marvel. And I think that the Batman versus Superman looks, very interesting. Again, Suicide Squad, I'm really looking at, but then you've got stuff like, you know, Finding Dory and Ghostbusters and a lot of that, you know, those kinds of movies, a lot of that kind of fare. So it should be an interesting year. But you know what? Maybe we'll be surprised. Maybe some of these movies will, you know, exceed expectations. Or there's what we call, of course, sleepers, movies that were not even on the radar. If we were sitting here over a year ago, nobody would have talked necessarily about The Martian winding up as this huge hit. And look what happened with that.
Only Ridley Scott would have.
That's maybe. Right. That's right. He knew.
Well, certainly for those of, and I'm kind of remembering how I introduced you a couple minutes ago and thinking, well, I should have, you know, explained a little bit more about who you were. And then I realized, wait a second, everybody knows who Paul Daguerre-Bedian is because, let's face it, you are probably more quoted than any entertainment CEO I know.
Well, it's only because I never stop. I haven't taken any time off, and actually, and I don't feel sorry for me at all. I love what I do. But it's funny because every Sunday morning, I've been working on those, you know, and with my RenTrak team, it's been amazing. But I work on the Sunday morning estimates. I've only missed two of those in 20 years. I've only not done the Sunday numbers or been involved in them twice in 23 years. So I love it. But yeah, it's fun. And you just have to be out there. And first and foremost, I'm a film fan, like I'm sure you and Michael are. I just love movies. And it really comes down to that. I mean, we put dollars and cents to it, and it is show business. But you know, that movie experience is just, you know, it's something I love, and I really love filmmakers and respect them. And it's just part of this whole crazy business we're in.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and especially at the end of the year or the beginning of the next one.
Yeah, it's a good time. Good time, Sperling. Thank you. Your questions are great. I really appreciate it very much. Well, and Michael, great insights from you as well. I do appreciate it.
Well, hopefully we can talk to you before the end of 2016.
Let's do it.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Well, that was great of Paul to join us. Of course, it would be silly to expect every year to be bigger than the year before. We've said that many, many times. So, you know, expecting 2016 to be automatically bigger than 2015 and yelling, oh my God, it's a disaster. It's a down year. It could be the second biggest year of all time and still be a down year. So, you know, put it in perspective. And that's the same thing goes for ticket sales. We've seen and we've looked from the 70s onward that ticket sales have kept pace with the growth of population in North America. We got higher ticket prices, more people in the country, but they're going to movies at about the same rate they have for 40 years, which is an amazing accomplishment because nowadays, every movie ever made is available at the touch of a button.
Yeah, I mean, look, you look at, I mean, certainly one of the things Paul just mentioned was that attendance, it didn't rise greatly, it didn't decline greatly, but at least it stayed the same, which is what you kind of want right now.
It grows over time. It's not going to explode.
Yeah. Universal Studios, though, you look at these movies, right? How many movies they made? 26 movies, 15 movies for Walt Disney. I mean, so 44.1% of the box office was made through 37 movies, 36 movies, something like that.
The big studios only release about 200 movies a year.
40 movies, sorry.
The big studios only release about, 200 movies a year?
Roughly 190, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's typical. One out of four movies, one out of five movies is going to click.
Yeah. Well, and quite honestly, if you're listening to this now, I'm sure our listeners are thinking, oh my goodness, you know, enough with the numbers.
Well, I hope not, because that's what the business is about. And speaking of numbers, how about $50 million? That's the number of money that Steven Spielberg invested in his own company. We talked about it before. Now we have the figure. Yes, he did invest in DreamWorks. He laid some money down on the table and said, I am excited. I think this is important. I want to show you that I am committed. He did it when the original company was launched. He and David Geffen and Jeffrey Katzenberg each invested $33 million in DreamWorks. Now that's spun off. Katzenberg has DreamWorks Animation. David Geffen is giving money to Lincoln Center. And Spielberg has brought DreamWorks home to Universal and invested $50 million of his own money. People said, oh, it would have gone for it anyway, but it showed that he wanted skin in the game, showed that he was, you know, really invested in every way in making DreamWorks happen. And some people said, oh, big deal for Spielberg. And I thought, well, I wonder, actually, what is he worth? Well, he's worth apparently between $3 and $4 billion.
Yeah, so, you know, $50 million, not a lot in the grand scheme of things, but I don't know whether it's he wanted to show that or the investor said, look, you know what? You put some skin in the game.
Well, they said it would have had the the anonymous quote said the deal would have happened anyway, but he just wanted to show good faith. But $50 million is 1.5% of his net worth, or in my case, it'd be the equivalent of $5.
Wait a second, I got to do some math real quick.
It's not a lot.
Well, so then when you're saying, not all that interesting, big whoop.
Well, exactly. It's a big whoop.
Okay, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, hey, you know what, Michael? Last Christmas, I gave everybody my heart, but the Beatles actually joined 9 streaming services.
Yeah. That's right.
Music lovers got a present this holiday. The Beatles joined 9 major streaming services on Christmas Eve, including iTunes, Spotify, Rhapsody, Amazon Prime, and more. As with CDs and digital sales, the Beatles held out and then went whole hog, making themselves available on major platforms rather than striking any exclusive deals. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. The Beatles are the greatest band of all time. I have 2 questions. 1, why? And 2, why not Pandora?
I would say that it's probably pay levels. And I think, couldn't you get Pandora? No, I guess you couldn't.
I don't know.
I mean, because
are they available on Pandora already, but just in single song versions?
I think so. I think that you can create.
So that's why they weren't mentioned, because they're already there, but it's not the same. And so nobody cares.
I would have to go back and double check that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case, because remember, Pandora, the way it stands now, not the way it stands next week or the week after. And I literally mean next week or the week after, at the rate that Pandora is moving toward a subscription on demand service. They are not an on demand service right now. They are radio. So they can pay for music under a compulsory license.
So they were probably there already. So my question is, did they limit themselves to paid platforms? I didn't see this answer.
No.
I looked around a little bit.
Because Spotify, and this is the reason Taylor Swift and Adele aren't on Spotify right off the bat, they do not
allow artists.
Correct. They say, look, you're either on our service or you're not. And if you're on our service, you're both on the free and the paid, so free and premium, or you're not. You can't just do premium. And that's why Taylor Swift said, really? Then I'm not going to release my music to you. Same thing with Adele. They just want it to be on the premium service where they get paid higher royalty rates. And Spotify said, I'm sorry, we don't do that.
I understand why they sell music on CD. I understand why they finally sell music digitally, even though they waited 5 years after iTunes was launched to do so. Why did they decide to go on to streaming services?
Look at the numbers. I mean, if you start looking at where the money is flowing, then
but they are not going to make money off streaming services the way they would on any other way.
No. But then it's either go to streaming or you're going to miss out on being a part of the conversation when it comes to millennials.
Part of the conversation comes to millennials. Well, that's what Billboard says, isn't it? I thought it was a good point. They said people will forget you.
Right.
This is how people listen to music. If you're not on the streaming services, they won't be listening to you, and the Beatles could fade and not be as important because people just aren't hearing their songs.
Well,
right? If they want to be heard and they want their music to survive and be valuable and be part of the culture, eventually they just had to crack and say, well, all right, we're not going to make money on it particularly, but we're going to put ourselves on these services because otherwise we'll be a little invisible, especially to people under 30.
Well, then Billboard said it way better than I just did.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting insight. I didn't have that when I was looking at it. I was wondering, why did they do this? And then Billboard told me why. So we have a link to that in our show notes. And I have to say, my nieces and nephews were playing the music all day long. They'd already loved Beatles, but they already knew the Beatles. I forced that on them. But they have good taste, and they were, you know, hey, they were playing the music. I bet a lot of people were.
Well, you know, they were either playing the Beatles or they were playing their Adele record.
That's right. She sold 1 million copies over the holiday weekend. So that's the third week that her album sold more than 1 million copies. That's pretty amazing.
And it's the highest selling, the best selling album since, well, Adele's 21, actually. So yeah, that album is just on fire. And you just knew that during the Christmas week, everybody was going to buy it for their mother.
Or their sister or an aunt or a nephew or, you know, niece, you know, everybody loves Adele.
That's true. Although now I'm sure we'll get emails from people who don't. A fan-funded prequel to the Star Trek TV series? You think that's possible? It was just a dream until some serious talent launched a Kickstarter campaign. And then, of course, you know what Paramount did, right? They launched a legal campaign. They raised, so this group that was trying to crowdfund this movie, they raised 7 figures, lined up a crew, and even met the CBS execs to make sure their little passion project wouldn't raise hackles. They said CBS execs felt their movies would never make a dime. So no one cared until they did. And then, you know, those people sued them to stop the project. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. What the heck happened? You know, I mean, we've got people who do Star Wars piece by piece on YouTube, you know, 5 seconds each or whatever. That's amusing. Obviously, this is a project they felt they had to stop in order to protect their rights. Could they have given their official stamp of approval and let it go forward? Because it's all right. This isn't going to harm us. It's fine. It's an actual little movie, but no one's going to make any money on it. And, you know, if they give their approval, that's not the same as letting it go forward unapproved, is it? I mean, there had to be some other choice between suing them or ignoring it.
Yeah, I think the problem is that once you don't
you can give your stamp of approval. I know that if you don't protect your copyright, but that's why you say, let's make this an officially approved project, in which case you are protecting your copyright. They came to you, they got approval, they paid for the rights and were allowed to do it, and thus it was official and legal. Isn't that the third way?
I guess so.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they just didn't want to do that because then they'd, you know, have a run on the
what?
You know, well, a whole bunch of people coming to them and saying, well, we'll make ours official and legal.
But then why didn't they? Well, they're not going to have people raising millions of dollars every week coming in with a movie project. And why did they meet with them and say it was okay? I just don't get it. It seemed pretty obvious at the start they should either say no or go the third way and say, yes, we'll give you approval because we think this is good enough that it will not harm our brand. And it's certainly not going to be a competitor, you know, financially. Go right ahead.
Yeah, well, and I think they probably ran into some legal snafu that they were unaware of.
Said, no, you must sue.
Yes, exactly. You know, they're not going to sue the U.S. Postal Service. That's for
right.
Sure.
They're putting out some more Star Trek stamps.
That's right. So, you know, reserve early. I guess they did it in 1999 and now they're doing it again. They look pretty good, these Star Trek stamps. Now, Michael, I know you're going to be happy about this next story because print is not dead.
Huzzah.
You already knew that if you listened to Showbiz Sandbox, but in a year when major publishers eagerly raised ebook prices to be the same and often more than print on major new releases, it's no surprise that print sales, as reported by Nielsen, would rise slightly to 571 million units. Nielsen, by the way, tracks about 85% of the print market, so thanks to no info from Amazon, we have only the vaguest idea of how ebooks are actually selling, but print is strong. The hand-selling, or bookstore, favorite, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, sold about equally in print and hardcover, while Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman sold about four times as many in print as it did in ebook. Sometimes, people just want a copy they can put on their shelves to make it look like they know something about something. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I would have said it was a big whoop because I thought it was partially due to the ridiculous overpricing of ebooks and also just the usual ups and downs. But in fact, some romance authors say they also see a resilience in print. Romance authors are really innovative and they push boundaries in technology a lot of times. And that genre has passionate fans. And they found, you know, they were big into ebooks early on and they've had great success there. And they say they're finding more and more fans who want to buy books and have a physical copy. So it may be just more than a blip on the screen, though I do believe ebook will continue to grow. One other bit of book news is that George R.R. Martin will not be publishing his new book before the new season of Game of Thrones. Why does that matter? Because the new season of Game of Thrones actually covers stuff that happens in the next George R.R. Martin book. Hasn't even been finished yet, and yet the TV series is now plowing ahead into unknown territory.
So they're going off book, so to speak.
Well, they've been off book for a while. They've killed characters who are still alive, and some characters are alive who are already dead. So they've diverged a little bit, always working hand in hand with Martin. And so they're doing that again. And so they're sort of parallel universes now. So it's kind of a weird, fun thing that the show will probably finish before Martin finishes the books.
I know that this is probably already a movie or play, but there. Oh wait, Misery, right? Where the fan says,
continue the series.
Yeah, exactly.
Or in this case, keep writing.
Kidnaps the person and says, "That's it."
I saw an ad for Misery on Broadway. That's the stage adaptation of the Stephen King novel, which was turned into a movie. Stars Bruce Willis and Laurie Metcalf, and the ad said quite accurately, "It's the number one thriller on Broadway."
As opposed to all of the other thrillers. Oh, wait, there are no other thrillers.
Exactly.
On Broadway.
I'm like, well done. They thought of something positive to say.
Now, Michael, I know this is going to also please you, this next story. If your broadband seems a little less pokey, you might be right. cable providers see the end of their big fat triple play packages, providing landlines, huge cable channel packages, and broadband services. That's going to come to an end. Many people don't see the need for a landline, and by many people we mean just about everybody. Some people who don't care about sports don't see the need for any cable package at all. And everyone hates the high prices and the annual ritual of calling up their cable provider, threatening to get satellite or go OTT over the top and then cut the cord just to keep their monthly bill from getting bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it's ridiculously... Anyway, so internet providers are actually, reacting in a few ways. They're raising prices for broadband. We know that. They're threatening to put data caps in place. And get this, they're actually improving service.
Huh?
Yeah, exactly. The U.S. isn't close to Europe, mind you. It's not, at least not yet. Europe is where genuine broadband competition means internet speeds are much better for much less money. But the FCC says that, in fact, broadband speeds are increasing in North America and often meeting the advertised rates. Go figure. Somebody actually advertises something and then gives it to you. Big deal or big whoop?
I'll say it's a big whoop.
I agree.
Because the advertised rates are often very broad and general and the low for them. You know, they say up to, you know, so their actual rates that they say they will meet is much lower than what you think from a quick glance. There isn't any real competition. There's competition from other categories, but not internal competition, meaning two or three people saying, I can provide you internet service in your home and here's how we're going to do it and we're going to give you better service. So I think it's not really a great thing. You know, it's crappy service still.
Comedian Bill Cosby.
I felt like we couldn't ignore it.
I know. But he is one step closer to court. He's been charged with sexual assault, released on bail, and now faces the prospect of a trial, perhaps testifying, and worse, the possibility of somehow the door opening to dozens of women speaking in open court about his apparent pattern of drugging and sexually assaulting them for decades. Some 50 women have come forth in the past year, all with similar stories. But only one woman's case seems to have fallen within a legal time span that makes a criminal case possible. Cosby's lawyers will surely fight any attempt to introduce the many claims that have surfaced and will also likely strive to keep him off the stand. And there's a reason for that. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's just the next stage. We'll have to see where it all ends. It's very sad. And when I say that, it's like, why should I feel sad for somebody who's clearly and probably a rapist? But it is. It's like you have this affection for someone you think you know over decades, and it's just weird and sad and awful. But of course, your real sympathy is for the women who were likely assaulted over all these years. Clearly, 50 women didn't come forward and make up their stories. I also feel bad for the people who worked on The Cosby Show. You know, this is a landmark, great, great TV show, hugely important, influential to the culture. And, you know, it's like they're the thing you want on your tombstone, Felicia Rashad and Malcolm Jamal Warner and all these other people who've done great work in other things. But maybe that was the first thing you were going to mention. And now it's been a little tainted by his horrible personal life. And it shouldn't be. And I think eventually we'll move beyond it. People still listen to Michael Jackson music. We don't worry about the terrible things he did probably in his personal life because that doesn't really affect the music. And hopefully someday the show and the work those other people did can be celebrated without thinking you're somehow giving Bill Cosby a pass.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that his lawyers will strive to keep him off the stand. They kind of have to. They have to because, you know, at this point, the case hinges on this this testimony he gave in a deposition for a civil suit, and the only way that can be introduced is if he takes the stand.
Yeah. So they're looking at some other ways of introducing it, so we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, look, like you said, you know, probably guilty, but at least
guilty
now
in the public of court, in the court of public opinion, no doubt.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's pretty much all we should say about that. So let's move on to something cheery. Thank you, Donald Trump. That's what Fox News is saying. From one frying pan to the next, Fox News is still the dominant player in 24-hour news channels, averaging 1.8 million viewers in prime time. CNN grew 38% with an average of 730,000 viewers during prime time. MSNBC, meanwhile, dropped 1% in total viewers and 18% in key demos, ending the year with 600,000 viewers in prime time. Of course, 2016 is an election year, so they'll all be crossing their fingers for a lot more debates and excitement. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? MSNBC lost and CNN, you know, gained. So that's the big news there. Fox is still on top. But I'm amazed at how much money they can make off just fewer than 2 million viewers in prime time.
Oh, I can tell you that when you are on basic cable like that, if you have 500,000 viewers watching your show during prime time, you are a hit. So if you have 600,000 or 730,000 viewers, you're doing quite well.
All right.
The London smash hit play, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, is making news for the casting of Hermione, or as I like to call her, Hermione. The show doesn't open until July, but we can call it a hit since it's sold out for practically every performance they've put on sale into 2017 and counting. And the casting of half-Muggle Hermione was news since she'll be played by, and Michael, you're going to have to help me here, is it Noma Dumezweni?
I think so, Noma Dumezweni.
Dumezweni. I'm sure we'll be saying her name. She's a black actress, very well known in the UK.
I don't know about that. Very well known.
A couple of reports I read said, look, all of these actors that have been picked are well known in the UK. So maybe they're well known in theater circles. Author J.K. Rowling enthusiastically endorsed the decision, pointing out that Hermione's skin color was never specified in the books. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop in the sense that, you know, like you say, the author has given approval. It makes sense. And it works in with the theme of the book, which is, of course, this sort of race prejudice, which, you know, Voldemort and his followers have against Muggles in particular. And they despise them and they're constantly mocking them as mudbloods. And so, of course, casting Hermione as a black person sort of adds a level of way into that idea and that world for us to appreciate a little bit more. However, someone else said, yeah, but you know what? Everybody's kind of dismissive of Muggles in the book, including, you know, Dumbledore and others. Always, oh, yeah, the dumb Muggles. And actually, there is sort of a generic assumption that Muggles are stupider. And
yeah,
so
that's true.
Maybe the book itself is a little prejudiced in that way. So it's kind of funny.
Apparently, the person playing Ron Weasley doesn't have red hair. And he said, but don't worry, he's a ginger at heart. That he tweeted out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Noma Dumezweni has some great credits. You know, she's on a number of TV shows, but I don't know that any of them are huge hits. But she's certainly, you know, she was on two episodes of Doctor Who. She's certainly not a nobody, but I don't think she's a big star as such. But, you know.
Either way.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll be a hit. No matter what.
Oh, it already is.
You know, I had to read Harry Potter from the sixth book. I had to read that to my kids over the break here. And I stumbled over all these non-Muggle words. And it was just, I mean, every time I hit one of these words for some creature or some potion, and they would just laugh that I got get the name wrong. And I just thought, wow, they're really into this. Okay, so moving on to the iconic TV series, The X-Files. It's going to return on January 24th in a 6-part miniseries. The truth is out there and over there and there as well, and probably behind me. Yes, the special event will premiere day and date in 60-plus countries, a wide opening that Fox specializes in, and which is becoming increasingly common for major TV properties. They've done it with The Walking Dead and Wayward Pines, to name two other shows, big deal or big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big deal, right? I mean, it's a big series. It's a great show. It's coming back. Hopefully it won't suck. But is this happening also because TV, like film, has moved to digital copies? Could they have done this 40 years ago?
40 years ago, maybe not. 10 years ago, yes. I mean, satellite, you could broadcast it whenever you wanted. I mean, it doesn't matter. What they're really...
weren't on tape even 20 years ago, right? They were now going digital.
Yeah, I mean, it's all pretty much satellite-driven now. You can beam the show to a head end anywhere. But the issue there is piracy. They know that the second...
Well, that's why they want it in all these countries right away.
Exactly. Because they know once it's out there and once it's on somebody's TiVo, they're going to download it onto their computer, decrypt it, and then upload it to BitTorrent, and then that's it.
But just as you can see movies opening around the world so easily now, you can do the same with TV shows.
Correct.
All right.
Columbia House, by the way, is the buy 10 albums for a penny and get monthly newsletters for the rest of your life. Mail order service. Beloved by those looking to expand their music collection or be sent a new album that they don't want every single month.
You should have responded and filled out the form and sent it back. It's your fault.
I know.
Do they do by email now, I wonder?
I wonder. Probably not, because the whole thing was that you didn't
respond. Depending on not responding.
Yes, exactly. Now, it began with LPs, expanded into 8 tracks, and then cassettes, and then finally CDs before disappearing for good. That's what this company did. Now it wants to make a comeback with... LPs, thank you very much. It's been brought out of bankruptcy and is looking to relaunch by focusing on their high-quality LP resurgence of recent years. These are vinyl LPs. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but it's kind of fun, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, Vinyl, we've talked about this. Vinyl LPs are kind of a niche market, right? And this whole concept of marketing music this way is kind of a niche idea at this point. So why not?
It's a good fit. Yeah.
Two niches don't make a... I don't have anything to finish that sentence, really.
Then don't try.
But we are finished with Big Deal or Big Whoop. And we are moving along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And over the Christmas holidays, the New Year's holiday, well, you know, it's kind of a slow news time, but that didn't stop Camper Van Beethoven singer from starting a class action lawsuit against Spotify.
Really?
Yeah, he's doing that for not paying royalties. He says Spotify knows it isn't compliant and keeps playing the songs anyway that they're not paying royalties on. Spotify says it's hugely difficult to track who should get what royalties, and they always set aside an estimated amount to pay off any royalties once the rights holders are identified. Spotify right now actually is in the midst of reaching a settlement with the National Music Publishers Association over similar issues and has a fund of around, what, like $20 million for payouts? And the class action lawsuit names about $150 million in payouts that are owed as a good starting point.
So do you think this is just another in the wave of lawsuits that are going to say, hey, where's our money?
I think that there are some recordings where the rights holders are not known. Okay, and I think they're playing those songs or allowing those songs to be put into on-demand services, and they're basically saying, look, we're going to keep this pot of money around for when these rights holders show up. It's just like what SoundScan does, right? Or I think it's Sound Exchange.
Right, but Camper Van Beethoven is like, hey, this album came out in 2014. You really think it's hard to track us down? I understand that for some obscure thing from decades ago, but I don't get it for an album that came out in 2014.
Yeah,
and they're saying, you know, you don't have the rights to this and you're playing it anyway.
Well, and Spotify said, and you know what we're going to do? They are basically disassembling their database. They're creating a database and a way to track all of this that will be transparent. So they actually came forward and said, yeah, we know this is kind of a mess and we're going to try and fix it.
So because of the lawsuits, they're changing the way they do business.
Yes, exactly. I think so. And not just Camper
Van
Beethoven.
So how will that impact the music that they play and the music that's available? Will that mean that there's less music on Spotify?
No, I think it just means that the tracking of it and the tracking of what has been played and who gets paid will be a little bit more transparent and a little bit easier for both Spotify and the rights holders to keep track of.
You get 0.4 of a penny and you get 0.4 of a penny and you get 0.4 of a penny.
Listen, streaming Oprah. Okay, well, that's kind of what's happening on Spotify. That I don't know if that will ever get to court, because I'm sure...
But they're already having an impact. These and other lawsuits are forcing Spotify to change how they work.
Yeah, but I think Spotify always knew that it had this issue, but...
Well, they're saying, yeah, you knew and you didn't bother.
But, you know, I would also say, look, you're trying to break new ground here. And you know what? If you just waited until everything was 100% correct and everything, you'd probably never launch. So you know what? Yes, did they have an issue with tracking the streams and the rights?
They've been around for 6 years, almost seven.
Are they behind on it?
No,
absolutely.
Sorry, 9 years ago, almost 10.
Yeah,
they started in 2006.
And when did you hear about them?
I don't know.
I can tell you when. 2012, 2010 at the earliest. So yes and no. I mean, I get what you're saying. But I also think that they're...
Well, you got to figure out how you're going to pay the people whose music you're taking.
Well, I think I do agree. Like 9 years later, you should probably have figured this out. You know, it should have been put on the priority list a little bit
Thank
sooner.
You. All right.
Okay. So now that moves us along from Spotify to another S company, another company named that begins with S.
Keep
Songkick. Songkick. And they're doing something else that begins with an S. They're suing Live Nation and Ticketmaster for abusing power to, I guess, they want to sell tickets direct to fans. And that's what they did with Adele, right? We talked about Songkick a week or so.
Artists want to sell tickets direct to fans. They don't want to have to use Live Nation and Ticketmaster.
Right.
There's a company called Songkick. They facilitate that. And, of course, they're now, most contracts, they get to set aside like 8 to 10% of tickets, and artists get to sell it to their fan club members and things like that. And Songbook is the company that makes money off of that. And they're saying in court that Live Nation and Ticketmaster are making it impossible for them to do business, that those companies are pressuring artists and telling them, you can't do that. If you do that, we'll make your life a living hell.
Right. Now, that 8 to 10%, of available tickets is a North American figure. Okay, so that's Live Nation and Ticketmaster in North America. As we learned with Adele, that is not the case in the UK, where Songkick could sell, you know, upwards of 50% of the tickets through her website. Now, what does direct-to-fan mean, and where does Songkick come into play? Basically, Songkick goes to these artists and says, look, you have your website, you have a fan club, you want to sell direct to fans, which means, oh, by the way, you make more money.
And don't have to give a cut to Ticketmaster and Live Nation.
Correct. And your fans don't have to pay these ridiculous, you know, surcharges. So everybody...
And you believe they're actually registered with you and are fans, so you're getting tickets to the people who want to see you, not to a third-party pirate who just wants to resell it.
And, oh, by the way, you're connecting and engaging your fans directly, which means you can reach out to them again when your new album is released.
Right.
Okay, so all of those things are true. And what Songkick is saying, guess what? We have a platform for that. You don't have to build it yourself. We'll just attach it to your website, okay? And when people go to your website, they can buy tickets. Now, they tried to do this in the U.S. And based on Ticketmaster and Live Nation, which is all, they're all the same company now, they're basically saying you have 8 to 10% of the available tickets for sale direct. We'll give them to you and you can sell them direct to your fans. But, you know, we don't really want you to do that. So if you do that, well, we just may or may not promote your concerts.
Right, so Songkick quotes one manager saying, Ticketmaster bullying is out of control, and we're not going to be able to do all tour pre-sales off-platform. They are just sticking it to us too hard. And they also say they have a global superstar, their term, whose name was not revealed, that they were denied marketing from Ticketmaster because they used Songkick, and they said they're ready to come forward with the information once certain agreements are put into place so that they can be announced and put out there in open court.
Right, so basically Songkick is saying, look, you can't, if you're a monopoly, which by the way you are, you can. There's no problem with that as long as you don't act in a negative manner towards others, as long as you don't restrict commerce. You're restricting commerce because you're basically telling people, well, you could go to Songkick for that 8 to 10% of available tickets, but then all of these other fees and all of these other rates that you would have been, you know, lower for you, Mr. Artist, are actually going to go much, much higher. So we're
and
sorry
ticket
about
sales
that.
And merchandise are where the money is.
Exactly.
Artists are not selling albums unless they're Adele or Taylor Swift. And even there, Taylor Swift's not selling a lot, just a couple million, not 10 or 15 like everyone did 20 years ago. You know, so going on tour, that's where you're not making money on, you know, streaming. Even the big artists aren't making a lot from that. You got to have 800 million views on Vivo or YouTube in order to get some money from that. So, hey, touring is where it happens, right?
Yeah. And basically, you cannot act if you're a monopoly, you cannot act in an obstructive way. And that's exactly what Live Nation is doing here. Now, that is what Songkick is
claiming,
correct, that Live Nation is doing. Hopefully it gets to court. I would love to see this go to court.
How can Live Nation, you know, keep it out of court? They can't settle because then the artist will have the door open, right?
I don't know what they could settle, but I don't know how they would settle. They could settle, but let's face it. Live Nation has their own direct-to-fan product that they're trying to tout, and they're trying to make it difficult for competitors to enter the marketplace. That's where the issue comes into play. I mean, if you're forcing people artists to use you 100% of your entire product line and there's no place for them to turn, that's where you're going to have an issue.
Right, and touring is where you make the money, and that's where we have the biggest acts of the year, isn't it? Taylor Swift. You know, Adele's tour hasn't started yet, and Taylor Swift was the biggest act of 2014 and 15.
Well, certainly 2015, her 1980.
Until Adele stepped into the breach with her new album. But on tour, Taylor's reigning queen, isn't she?
Okay, so you were talking about album sales. Yes. Her 1989 tour, Taylor Swift's 1989 tour, made $250 million worldwide. Almost $200 million of that came from North America. And I guess she trampled over the North American record of $162 million, which was the Rolling Stones.
I believe that was the record.
I know. But think about it. It is now 2015, or it's now 2016, but last year was 2015, and the record was from 2005, the Rolling Stones, $162 million. So that lasted for 10 years, that record.
Pretty impressive. But what I love is that she sold 2.3 million tickets.
That's right. That's right.
Worldwide. So that's like, is that $10 a ticket or that's $100 a ticket? That's about...
$100 a ticket, right?
No, $100 would be a ticket, would be 23. Yeah, yeah, 100, it is $100.
Yeah, yeah. Minus the one, carry the two.
So that's pretty pricey.
Yeah, well, that's how much concert tickets go for these days.
And full credit to her, 1989 has sold almost 9 million copies worldwide so far. So that's pretty good numbers in any day and age. But they're just one of the few to actually move tickets. But she's number one, followed by AC/DC, $180 million from 54 shows. One Direction, they had $158 million. U2, a shortened tour thanks to Bono's injury, $152 million. And Foo Fighters, who broke into the top five for the first time in their history, with $127 million. And that's after breaking his leg.
That's true. And you're talking about Dave Grohl there, their front man, who spent half the tour sitting on stage with his leg in a cast, and everybody loved it.
So the top 20 tours generated $2.2 billion in sales.
That should tell you something, right? I mean, now we know how much money the box office makes and how much money the concert industry makes from the top 20 grossing tours.
And that doesn't include merchandise and food and drink and stuff like that.
Oh, no. That's just tickets.
So that's an increase in dollar amount, $200 million over the year before. And happily, it's also an increase in ticket sales. They were up 20% over 2014. I don't have a breakdown of ticket sales in North America. Is this North America or worldwide?
I think it's worldwide. It's worldwide,
isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any good measure of tickets. I don't think such a thing is possible. But I guess you're talking about the top tours. If you talk about the top 20 tours, you can get maybe a rough estimate of ticket sales there. But at least they're up from the year before pretty substantially. So people going back to shows.
Yeah, okay. And all of that information we should kind of credit to Pollstar, which tracks this kind of stuff for the concert.
Right, we pulled the story from the LA Times.
That's correct, because Pollstar hasn't actually officially announced it yet. That comes January 8th.
All right.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that brings us not only to the conclusion of this show, for the most part, but also to the conclusion of some lives over the past...
terrible segue,
but I don't know how to move into this other than to say, if you are a cinematographer, and all these things, you know, they always say famous people die in threes. Well, if you're a cinematographer, you better be looking out, because two world-renowned cinematographers passed away over the holiday break.
That's right. Haskell Wexler, the Oscar-winning cinematographer, and Vilmos Zsigmond. Did he win an Oscar?
Yes, he did.
Close Encounters?
Yes, indeed.
Yes. So Vilmos also won an Oscar. Both Oscar-winning cinematographers. Haskell was 93. Vilmos, I'm on a first-name basis. He died at 85. Great careers. I think most of their great work was done in the 70s. Not surprising. It was a great year for cinema. But, you know, they had long, noble careers. Also dying recently was Lemmy from Motorhead, a big singer in the hard rock band. Natalie Cole, who was plagued by illnesses for a number of years. She died at 65. And finally, Wayne Rogers, who played Trapper John on MASH. He died at 82. Now, they all have interesting careers. They all have great stuff you should check out, especially Vilmos and Haskell. I mean, Haskell did some great movies. He worked on The Conversation, but was fired from that movie. But one of my favorite films, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, did great work on that. And Vilmos did a great little movie called Scarecrow from the 70s. That starred Gene Hackman and Al Pacino. It's a movie most people probably haven't seen. It's an actor showcase, and it's a lovely little film. You see it, and you go, why haven't I heard of this movie before? It's great. I think Close Encounters is underrated. I think that is a great, mature adult film. It's not a kiddie movie at all. I think it's just a terrific movie. And if you haven't seen it in a long while, you know, give that movie a look, because it is really a terrific film.
You'll get differing opinions on whether these two cinematographers were part of either what is called the New American Cinema or the American New Wave of the 1970s.
Exactly.
You know, there's some, you know, people kind of, journalists kind of equated them to both those movements, which are the same movement. Basically, it's Martin Scorsese, Francis Coppola, George Lucas, you know, Steven Spielberg, this whole group of filmmakers working in the 70s and bringing the American film industry back into glory, so to speak.
So those people all had long, interesting careers, except for Wayne Rogers. I think he's there strictly because of MASH. If he hadn't been on MASH, we wouldn't be talking about him. No insult to the rest of his life. He did stock stuff. He appeared on Fox News. He did other stuff over the years. He produced and directed and acted in other things. But clearly, MASH was the movie that's on his tombstone. And, you know, why not? It was one of the most groundbreaking TV shows of all time. He was only on it for the first 3 years. Back in the 70s, and still that is what we remember him for, and that's what people have affection for Wayne Rogers for, because he was on one of the most, you know, influential TV shows of all time. That and All in the Family tore up the rule book on sitcoms, and he was a fool to leave the show, but by God, those first 3 years were great.
And, you know, Natalie Cole, I was surprised so many people were moved by her passing. I know her mostly from, you know, 1991's unforgettable duet with her father, you know, the virtual duet, so to speak.
Right. That was by far her biggest hit album. Not remotely, I think, her best work, but that certainly was hugely acclaimed and, you know, a lovely claiming of her legacy. Imagine growing up the child of Nat King Cole, one of the biggest stars of all time, important on so many levels and just a great pianist and singer, but, you know, socially important, culturally important. And, you know, to be under that shadow and still have a substantial career and do good stuff. She had lots of troubles in her life with addiction and other things, but, you know, she delivered a great career. And I think people are sad because she's so young. She's only 65.
Yeah. Well, we do have one piece of listener email here that I think we can read, which is from Joe Gaze. Do you want to read it?
I haven't read it, so why don't you? Because I don't know what it says. What's it about?
It is about business date versus sale date versus, you know, remember a week or so ago?
When we were talking about like Star Wars?
Yeah, the opening of Star Wars and why they count certain days and when they count them. Okay. And Joe Gaze wrote to us. He says, I know this is way too deep in the weeds for the show. Actually, it's not.
But we love the weeds.
That's where we live. The reason the studio must use business date for advanced ticket sales is due to the concept of revenue recognition. And that is when money collected can be put into earnings. Just because you collect money for something, it is not earned until you deliver the product or, in this case, show the movie. When Apple sells the iPhone in advance and collects millions of dollars for all those iPhones, they can't recognize revenue until the iPhone ships for each order.
Oh, great. Well, that's a very clear, direct explanation. Thanks, Joe, for writing in. I appreciate that. I'll probably remember that now.
Well, that said, okay, the way exhibition works is the revenue isn't recognized until it is reported as a box office report 21 days after the, you know, the show date. So
box office revenue in December 10th would not be reported, or December 15th would not be reported until 2016
would not be recognized revenue until there's
and that's why the financial quarters don't track the yearly quarters.
Correct.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
But certainly as far as the software goes, the business date of when something sells versus the actual sale date are different.
Woo! Well, we made it through the first box office, the first showbiz sandbox of the new year.
Yes, and hopefully you're not your head isn't spinning with figures. It probably is, though. But you know what? If you liked all those numbers you heard, we've got one more for you. 5. That's the number of stars you should give us on iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review us on any of those platforms, and you can subscribe.
Especially iTunes, because there we were, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, checking, did you rate and review our show? Did you rate and review our show? Hoping for that Christmas miracle, and it didn't come. You know, you haven't done it yet. Go, if everybody who listened to this show rated it, that would make a huge impact on how iTunes promoted us and made us visible and bring us a whole new audience. It would really make a big difference.
That is beyond true. Everything Michael just said is more than true. I can't
Super true.
It's super true. So please do subscribe and rate and review the show in iTunes, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can, of course, write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, and also links to the work of Paul Dagarabedian, who I thank for joining us. He's from RentTrack, of course, and I'd like to thank him for taking so much time to speak with us about the 2015 box office, the 2016 future box office, and really the industry in general. What else should we say? Well, you can follow us on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. You can also like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's heshotfirstgeorgelucas.com.
Oh my goodness, if you get that, well, you're probably around my age.
Absolutely.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there. You can try the Huffington Post, or you can go to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work aggregates. You can also visit bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.